Hey everyone, welcome to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and this is a place where I bring you authentic conversations with people who are willing to share their journey through seasons of grief. No matter your cultural upbringing, societal conditioning, or faith practice, grief affects us all. Whether you're dealing with a loss, a diagnosis, a broken heart, or the everyday stressors of life, or love someone who is, these conversations are here to support you in that process. So be sure to check out the show notes for potential trigger warnings. And whether you're very comfortable with or deeply avoidant of grief and its many responses, you are welcome here. Thank you for being here, and now on to the episode. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Grief Informed Podcast. I am your host, Rachel Garcia, and today I have with me John Onwuchekwa, which I can say Dr. John Onwuchekwa. That's right. He's a storyteller, author, and founding pastor of Cornerstone Church in Atlanta, Georgia. And I love these two descriptors of his work. John is a storyteller painting a picture of hope with different shades of grief and living in hopeful defiance no matter what it looks like outside. Welcome to the podcast, John.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. I know there's a lot of different places we could jump in, but before, I would like everybody to know who you are, a little bit about you. Could you tell us your cultural upbringing and background?
Yeah. I was born in Houston, Texas. So the third of five kids to immigrant parents. So my parents are Nigerian. They came here to the States in the mid to late 70s, right? Mm. So I grew up in a household that was very Christian, you're really Christian, right? So my mom and dad were those that they really, really, really believed their faith, right? I grew up in a household where people talked better than they lived. Mm. And as a result of that, I stayed away from it because I saw that it was all taught. My dad is a preacher, right? My mom is a preacher. And I can look back and say, nah, both of them, they can talk well, but they lived better than they talked, right? They believed and they put into practice all of the things that they said. So that was household that I grew up in. Life was full. Hospitality was more than a core value of our home. Like, it was the water that we swam in. So grandparents, friends, you know, cousins would stay for long, long time. So our house was always full. Yeah.
That's amazing. And you said five kids?
Five kids.
And you're number three. You're the middle child.
I'm the middle child. Two older brothers, two younger sisters. Me and my wife have one daughter. She's seven, Ava. Yeah. But my mom and my dad have 20 grandchildren. So that just lets you into how kind of full things are. So me and my wife are the deviation from the norm.
So do you know your Enneagram number?
Yes. So the last time I took it years ago, I was a two wing three.
Yes. So the helper, which that's exactly what I am, the two wing three. And it makes sense that your three is strong because of what you do, the public facing.
And that's the thing. People think that I'm an achiever and they do not know that I am not. They don't know that all of the stuff that like gets done for me, it's like, it's incidental. Like, I didn't chase it. It's like, oh, this just happened.
Yeah.
Like, I'm too lazy to really be an achiever and to set goals. And like, I love watching TV and procrastinating way too much to actually live my life for the accomplishment of things. I'm content with floating
through life. You would much rather, I believe, tell me if this is wrong, as a two-wing three, much rather focus on connection than admin or anything related to the success of.
Yes,
people, and that's why when you said hospitality in your family, you being a two, I'm sure especially were loving all of the connection that you had. with everybody.
Oh, yeah. I love it.
Yeah. And hospitality was opened my eyes to when I learned the Enneagram was I remember learning the spiritual gifts of hospitality. And it wasn't an issue of organization and your home looks like Martha Stewart. It was the open doors policy of like, I just want connection. You just come into my home. Absolutely. I'm going to feed you. Yeah, we're going to connect. So I love that. You're a two as well. Okay, so little fun fact, you just finished up your dissertation and are now Dr. Onwuchekwa. Yeah. So tell me about that process. What brought you to that?
I started a doctoral program a decade ago when I was 30. Spent 6 years on it, researching, writing. I took a brief pause when my brother passed and when my daughter was born. So finished all of the coursework, was it the dissertation and the writing stage, and found myself in some ideological differences with the not necessarily the institution, but the denomination that the institution was connected with. Left the denomination in public fashion in 2020 and just felt like, hey, if my words are really going to have any legs or any weight, then it, as far as I've come here, it's, I think, integrity, at least for me, would just lead me to say, hey, if I'm really going to leave, I'm going to leave. So I left that doctorate on the table and just withdrew. And it's like when you withdraw from a doctoral program, it's not like a bachelor's degree, like, oh, I'm just going to transfer and take all my credits with me. It's like, oh, no, when you withdraw, if you're going to go back, you start completely over. So that's what I did.
And was it the same topic?
No, different topic.
Okay, so then you switched it, and the topic is about grief.
So I switched. Yeah, it's about grief. So I started the program as I was finishing up the last book that I wrote, We Go On. Funny enough, the book was supposed to be, my first book was supposed to be on hope through the lens of Ecclesiastes. But then as I wrote the book, and we produced subsequent content, right? The 3-part mini doc that me and my close friend Rich Perez produced, as we did that stuff. One of the things that I found was that coming out of the pandemic, people would say, oh yeah, no, all the hope stuff was good. But they were like, I felt seen and heard when I heard you talk about grief. And so it was like the handlebars that folks latched onto. And so from my standpoint, I like calling is a tricky thing. But when I think about calling, I constantly think not just about like what I want to do, or I don't feel that calling is as mystical as folks make it. In some ways, it feels very natural and providential. It's like like in the Bible, right? Moses and the burning bush, right? I think in our minds, we imagine that like Moses is walking and there's some inner prompting and angels singing that kind of draw him over to the bush. But yeah, you know, the Bible says that he walks over and he's like, oh, that's interesting. There's a bush that's on fire that's not consumed. And he walks over and that's what leads him into his call. So for me, it was the same thing. It was like, I wrote this. I was trying to be helpful. Oh, this is interesting. Everybody in the world that I know of that read the book that didn't even know they were grieving, they start to feel it. But interestingly enough, it's like they're wanting to talk about grief, but they're not consumed with despair. Let me peer in and see what's here. And so that led me to really start to, you know, think and explore more. And so as I got into the program, it was just, I really want to lean into this because I've seen just how much my life has changed and other folks' lives have changed. And the more that I started to kind of dig deep, the more I had what I felt like were, well, I felt like they were pretty profound revelations, if you will, and things that I was just like, I've never thought about it this way, and this is so helpful. And the more that I would talk about the things that I've found, right? So it's like, I definitely put off writing my dissertation to the very last minute because I was too busy connecting with folks. But the more that I would talk, the more folks say, oh yeah,
you gotta write it down.
That's good. That's good. Right. Yeah.
So I mean, as a pastor, I can imagine, a founding pastor at the time, that you've had a career of hearing stories and being with people and meeting them in their own losses and grief. I'm curious, what can you tell us what your initiation into that has been?
Yeah. Francis Weller is going to call it an apprenticeship with sorrow, right? Mm-hmm. And so mine came April 14th, 2015. Mm-hmm. I am in Orlando, Florida, getting ready to speak at a conference. It is a conference on heaven. And I'm getting ready to speak at this conference. And I'm at dinner the night before I speak with a guy who spoke that morning, close friend of mine. And as we're at the table, my left pocket starts to vibrate. And so I pick it up. I look real quick. It's my mom. So I, you know, send it to voicemail and I'm like, she'll call back. Well, she keeps calling. So I excuse myself out of the restaurant, right? I stand up. And as I walk out of the front door, I'm on the phone and she's like, hey, I'm trying to get a hold of your brother. Can you give him a call and tell him to call me? And I'm like, yeah, sure. So I call around and I get on the phone with my godbrother. And as I'm on the phone with my godbrother, I hear him say, Sam, that's my brother's name. He's like, yeah, Sam passed out. And so I'm like, oh, well, wake him up, right, if he passed out. What he really said was Sam passed away. And so he's like, hey, Sam passed away. And I just remember like staring at my phone, like screaming the words into my iPhone, like, he's dead. He's dead. He's dead. Like, I remember like my knees knocking together. I remember the unevenness of the pavement. I remember the way that people's faces so effortlessly twisted in between like shock, horror, and despair as they looked at me and tried not to look at me. Yeah. And that was when it all started. And it was just from that point on, you know, the best way I can describe it is my life just felt rearranged, right? Like, I grew up in Houston, Texas. I left in 2002 to go to college and I haven't lived there since. I go back there 22 years later and I recognize some of the same streets, but everything's moved, like all the buildings and things are new. And so it's not, navigating around the place that I grew up is not the same. And it's the same thing with life, right? Like when you lose somebody, it's like, you know, some of the streets in your memory and life is still the same, but your life has been like reorganized. Pre-2015 and post-2015, if there is a line of demarcation in my life, April 14th, 2015 is that line of demarcation. He was right above me, a year and 4 months older. We were 16 months apart. He was, out of all of my family, he was the one that like everybody was like closest to. So it's like I was closest to him. My oldest brother was closer to him than he was to us. My younger sister was closer to him. Like he was just kind of that, like, the train station where all of the stops came through and felt at home. So.
What was his name?
Sam.
Oh, that's beautiful. So you have this experience and I'm, when you came up with this, but you talk about grief in as a language. And can you tell us about that? I know, quote being that if humanity were a country and you go, because it's amazing.
So this is the heart of all of my research, right? All of the work that I've done in grief. It's actually the theme and the title of this next round of We Go On Tours that we're getting ready to do. It's January 2016, and I am 9 months removed from his death. I'm 7.5 months removed from starting my third church in 10 years, right? So started the church 6 weeks after his death. And I thought I hurtled past my grief. I thought I jumped past it. I was impressed with how quickly it of was course. Like, hey, I know grief sits with folks, but I'm okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And I found myself making a pit stop in the parking lot of Lenox Mall in Atlanta, Georgia, getting ready to take back a pair of shoes. And to make a very long story short, a group of kids steals a parking spot that I was waiting on. And I rolled down my window. I just got done doing chapel for the Texas A&M basketball team. And I'm getting ready to like preach the next day. And when I tell you these kids stole my spot and they didn't care, they got out the car, rolled down the window, and Rachel, I cussed them out. And what was more shocking than the fact that I cussed them out was the fluency that I had. I hadn't cussed anybody out in 15 years.
Like riding a bike.
But I'm like, you don't forget, it comes back. So and then as soon as I do that, like, I just feel this sense of, oh, shame. I mean, shame is riding a shotgun with me in the car seat. I get a spot right next to the one that I lose. I call my wife and, best friends at the time, and I tell them what I did. And I just say the words, I'm not okay.
Yes.
And they say, we know that you're not okay.
Yeah.
We're just waiting on you to say that you're not okay. Mm. And it was at that point I took a sabbatical from the church, a time where I couldn't hide my pain behind the anesthesia that comes from helping people put their lives back together, right? Mm. And I started reading the book of Ecclesiastes, and it was there that it's like, the book starts off and I felt a deep solidarity as the author was saying, meaningless, meaningless, everything's meaningless.
Yeah.
And what made me feel at home was the fact, or what gave me so much hope was the reality that, wait a minute. I felt like everything's meaningless because I feel like I've lost it all. Here, he has it all, and he says that it's meaningless. And so if I can be depressed in a valley and he can be depressed on a mountaintop, maybe depression isn't circumstantial.
Right.
And if depression isn't circumstantial, maybe hope isn't either.
Mm.
Maybe joy isn't either, right? Maybe nothing about the life that I know has to change, and everything about life can change. And it was like, maybe tragedy doesn't ruin anybody. Maybe hopelessness does. And I think I used to ask myself every morning, like, is today going to be the day that I finally get better? Is today going to be the day that people ask me how I am and I say fine, and I don't feel like that my nose is going to like Pinocchio, right, and poke them in the eye? Is today? And as time went on, I realized nothing was wrong with my questions. Everything was wrong with my answers and what they did to me. And I realized, like, this is 9.5 years later. I realized I haven't reached a finish line to grief because there is none. Like, grief doesn't have an expiration date. There is no finish. And so a lot of my work was really aimed at the fact that, metaphors help us understand reality.
Yes.
They shape how it is we relate to things. And it's bad metaphors create like these very wrong expectations. And so from my standpoint, I think grief as a journey is not just an unhelpful metaphor. I think it's a harmful one because it leaves people looking for something that's not there, right? It leaves people searching for needles in needleless haystacks, right? Yes. Like, there is no end to this thing, right? As long as you live, you're going to live with a sense that what you loved, you lost, and you can't recover it, right? You live with a sense of the realizations of all I have are the memories of this person, and I will not be able to make any new memories. And the memories that I have are like wet ink, and time is going to raindrop on that page. So the memories that I do have are going to wash away and get fuzzy, right? So I don't even have those in perpetuity. Grief isn't a journey. Journeys have starts and ends.
Yeah,
I do think it's more helpful to think of grief as a language, right? The goal of a language is not to finish. The goal of a language is to become fluent. The purpose of a language is connection. I want to learn how to speak so that I can relate to you, you can relate to me, and we can bond. And one of the things that we find is like grief tempts us to isolation, right? Grief pulls us there. Francis Weller's going to say it again, like what grief does is it makes us, it tempts us towards amnesia or anesthesia. We want to forget the law. All right, I just want to live. I don't want to be a widow, a divorcee, orphan. Yeah. I don't want to be that loss. So we act like that it's not there. Or anesthesia, we numb ourselves. Yes. I don't want to think about it. I just want to move on. And what we find is that what both of those things do is both of those things isolate us from the rest of humanity who goes through that same loss, right? That what grief does is it welcomes us into a community of people who have these broken hearts that haven't reduced their capacity to love, but has actually made space for them to love in ways that they never thought possible. And when we neglect that reality and don't lean into the fact that the purpose of our grief is for greater love, then we find ourselves isolated, right?
Yeah.
Trying to live as if this is a journey. It's a marathon where I don't get to tag anybody in, and success is I've got to make it to the finish line. And yeah, that's not the case at all.
Yeah. The language aspect. I love the dialects too, because everybody's losses are different. And that's one of the things you brought words to a concept that as soon as you said it, I said, that's it. The tangible versus ambiguous grief. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. The thing about a language is every language has multiple dialects, right? Mm-hmm. With grief, there's at least two. Tangible grief and ambiguous grief. Tangible grief is this. I have a loved one, they die. Their body is dropped into the ground. Tears sprint from my cheeks, chasing their body into the ground. Everybody around me sees a fallen body, fallen tears. They connect the two. And what you have is a group of people that surround you with hugs and handshakes and Uber Eats gift cards and casseroles and how you doing and praying for you. And you've got a support system to help carry you through that grief. There's another dialect that's not spoken very well, and that's ambiguous grief, right? Ambiguous grief is the death of a dream, the death of a friendship, the death of a marriage, the death of your idealized picture of somebody in your mind, right? It's like my friend Stephanie says, she defines it as somebody living, but not as they once were, right? Ambiguous grief is the diagnosis of a parent with dementia, where even though they're still here, you talk about them in the past tense.
Yeah.
These are deaths with no funerals, funerals with no caskets. And what you find is that when the tears are falling, people surrounding you, they do not have a casket to connect it to. Yeah. And so from their standpoint, it's like,
why are you upset?
I don't understand why you're sad. Look at all the stuff that you have, and people just don't get it. So you have people whose body physiologically responds in the same way. So you talk about the way that your heart literally swells as you grieve, and it doesn't care if it is a tangible or an ambiguous loss. So everything in your body is saying, this is grief, and there aren't people to validate it. And so it feels, if amnesia or anesthesia are the ways that we isolate ourselves in our grief, I think apathy is the way that other people isolate us in ambiguous grief, in that they just don't see or don't care to see or don't care.
Yeah. I just had this question, and were there any suppositions in your research that you were surprised by?
Oh, yes. I really spent a lot of time trying to learn the process of language acquisition, right? Mm. How do people learn languages? What's the use of it? How was written language created? What was it created for? And, after it became clear, all right, grief not as a journey, grief as a language is a much better metaphor, dialects of grief. And it's like, all right, how do people learn language? They learn it in two ways, by immersion and by patience, right? Mm. People can be quick to learn a language, but nobody learns an entire language overnight. It takes time, right? And it doesn't just take time. There is a difference in fluency between somebody that learns how to speak in a classroom and somebody that learns how to speak in a country or surrounded by it. And once you start to do that, right, it was like, all right, then I start to go down there and I learn a lot about immersion patience, and you start to see patience as a virtue, and you start to ask or read, all right, how are virtues cultivated? And this was the big thing for me, right? Virtues are not cultivated through propositions or through sermons. Mm. Virtues are cultivated through story.
Mm.
So my daughter, if I need her to be patient, I'm not going to say, hey, Ava, sit down. You need to be patient. Here are three reasons why. Mm. And then at the end, patience is just going to work in side.
Right.
I have to engage her heart. And the method through which virtues are cultivated is through storytelling. That I could give her a lecture on it, or I could say, Ava, no, look, once upon a time, there was a tortoise and there was a hare.
Mm.
And the thing about stories is stories have this truth, but this truth is sealed in this time-locked vault. I'm going to give you the truth, but you're actually going to have to practice the virtue I'm trying to cultivate in listening to the story. You have to wait. But once you wait, you're going to see the payoff. Your ability to retain it's going to be better because it comes in a story. And so storytelling really becomes this huge part of it. And you see, there's kind of two ways that it comes up. And forgive me, you're the first one to ask about this for a long time. So I'm excited to talk through. Dr. Kendall Haven has this book called The Science Behind Story. And one of the things that she talks about is the fact that story predates written language. So written language was created to tell stories, right? The purpose of language. It's to tell those things. And then Natasha Trethewey, she wrote this book, Memorial Drive, where she reflects, it is a memoir where she reflects on the murder of her mother, and it's a serendipitous story. But then at the very end of it, one of the things that she's going to say is this, to survive trauma, one must learn how to tell a story about it, right? That's the way that we survive. That's the way that we move through, being able to tell stories about the ones or the things that we've loved or we've lost. So it is a grief doesn't have an expiration date. Therefore, we shouldn't think of grief as a journey. Maybe it's more helpful to think of grief as a language. The way that we learn language is by immersion and patience. The way we cultivate patience is actually through storytelling. And it is this type of storytelling that leads us into the thing. It is the most useful tool when it comes to help us metabolize the grief that we have into something beautiful.
Wow. So how do you recommend we go about doing that?
Okay. I'm giving you something, and it's like I'm starting to work on this. It has not been written down anywhere.
Work
it's
in progress.
Go on the road with me. This is part of the book. It is a, I think one of the ways that we can help people is to graduate. Right, from saying sorry for your loss to why don't you tell me a story about your love? That when somebody says that they've lost something, or when you find out, it usually comes in the course of we're having a conversation about something else.
Right.
And it's like, oh yeah, I'm going over to my brother's house for the weekend. And it's like, oh, do you ever do anything with your brother? And they'll say, no, my brother was brutally murdered 3 years ago. And they're like, ah, sorry for your loss. And the goal is let me acknowledge the loss. And then let me like put the car in reverse and just try to back at like, I drove into a thing that I, right. And it's like, when you say that, and that's all that you say, I do think you tend to reduce somebody's loved one to the tragedy or the loss. And it is a cordial way of saying, oh, I'm sorry about your loss. I don't mean to cause any pain.
Yeah.
All right. Let me feel things out. All right. Are we done with that? All right, cool. Can we get back to what it is we talked about? Grief doesn't let us live until our love has been honored, right?
Yeah.
And when you say, tell me a story about your love, you're saying, oh, yeah, I'm sorry to hear about the loss of your brother. I mean, I'm sure that must have been hard. Like, what was he like? How were you shaped? Do you want to talk about him? And it's saying, no, let's stay there. Like, if he is gone, then all that is left of him in this world are the memories that are trapped inside of stories. And if they aren't shared, then they die with the only person that has them. And those things need to be shared. And I do think it's a, this was, I think, modeled so clearly in the lives of my two dear friends. So Jordan and Jessica, Jordan's 43, Jessica's 42. They both live in Harlem. Mm-hmm. Started a church, pastor a church out there. They're in their early 40s, but this is their second marriage each, because both of them were widowed in their late 20s.
Oh, wow.
Jessica's husband died 2 months, 2.5 months into their marriage. Tragic motorcycle accident. Jordan's wife less than a year into their marriage, gets a rare form of cancer. So mm-hmm. rare that when the doctor tells him what she has, he also says he had to Google it because it is that rare.
Oh, wow.
She dies. In between the time their spouses die and they meet each other, they date people. The relationship gets to a certain depth and then it stops, primarily around the loss of their loved one, where the people that they're dating, I don't really want to talk about it. I don't want to bring it up. I think it's going to make you sad. You talk about them a lot. You talk about how you still love them. You do this. It kind of makes me jealous. I wish it could just be me. And both of them are like, I can't really explain. I can't put things into words. And then they find each other. And as they meet and as they start to date and talk, they talk not just about their love for each other, but they talk about their loves that they lost. And they're both like, no, I get it. Tell me more about her. Tell me more about him. And they're both like, oh, if you're ever really going to know me and who I am, they're an important part of me. So unless I tell you a story about my love that I lost, you're only going to get so deep with me. And they did that and they found this unique bond. And they were the ones that really helped me see, like, oh, sorry for your loss only gets you so far, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's grief 101. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Well, you also make some great, amazing quotes that I wrote that I wanted to ask you about. And you can, whatever it is you want to add to them.
Okay.
Grief is the beginning of an ongoing conversation we have for the rest of our lives. Everything you love, you will lose. It's not meant to make you sad. It's meant to make you sober. Anything that you want to add?
Yes.
To that?
Francis Weller. And I just have to be sure whenever
I love
I bring
him
that
too.
Up, oh my goodness.
Yes.
He has this book, The Wild Edge of Sorrow. So the amnesia and anesthesia stuff, it was that's him. I was reading it this morning and it just stuck again. I've read it 1,000 times, but it was like I read it for the first time. So he talks about these gates of grief that you have to walk through. And he's like, oh, this is the first gate of grief. What grief reminds us of is everything in this world that you love, you will lose. And people hear that and they're like, ah, you brought the mood down. That makes you sad. And no. And it's not meant to make you sad, right? It's meant to make you sober. It's meant to make you this better, more present version of yourself. And the things that I said in the past, like, no, this is what grief does. Like when we're taking our loved ones for granted and we're sitting down on the couch, or it's like we took the train up into downtown tonight and it's me, my wife, and my daughter. And we're there and it's like out of habit, I like pick up my phone and I'm scrolling through my phone. And when we do that, what grief does, grief like slithers up our spine and it taps you on the shoulder and whispers menacingly into your ear. No, listen, hey, everything in this world that you love, you'll lose.
Yeah.
Even her, even this time. So, John, put down your phone. Like, put it down. Like, you like bury your nose in her, right? Yeah. Make sure that like you take advantage of this time. And it is like knowing the fragility of life. Without that reminder, I think I would continue to live life as if good things last forever. And bad things happen to other people, not me. But grief reminds us of, oh, no. Listen, it happens to everybody, even you, especially you. So far from bringing the mood down, it ensures that in any setting you say there is an advantage to being here as opposed to being in the grave.
Yeah.
I'm going to make the most of it.
Yeah. Absolutely. You mentioned about grief being dropped on you, big grief versus little deposits over time.
Oh, man. Yeah. I think when it comes to grief, and this was a lesson that I learned from Preston, my friend Preston, like when you think about like wealth, right? There's two ways to grow wealthy, right? One is to win the lottery, get an inheritance, lump sum dropped on you. So you go from being broke one day to being very, very rich the next overnight. You're rich. Another way to grow wealthy is by taking advantage of compound interest. And it is, put $1,000 in the bank when you're born, put $1,000 in the bank every week. And 30 years later, even though you haven't made any large lump sum, the compound interest makes you very, very rich, right? Mm. Grief is the same way. You don't have to have the death of a loved one, right? You can live a life where you have the constant deposits of betrayal by friends, betrayal by people who have power and should use their power to protect you, but instead they use their power to exploit you, right? Mm. Like, you can live your life with these deposits that are so constant that you wake up one day, and even though both of your parents are alive and you've never had to bury a cousin, you have so much unmetabolized grief in and around you that it just renders you emotionally immobile, and you just, right, can really be very, very rich in grief, even with no lump sum dropped on you. And so I think that distinction is important for folks to make, who would take grief and assume that grief, that only people who have sat in a chapel in a black suit or a black dress and buried loved ones have the permission slip to be able to use the word grief to talk about how they are. And no, that is not the case at all. Right.
Right. Absolutely. So what do you think is something that for those of us that are all of us when we're grieving, what do you think can trip us up in our grief? What can compound the grief and the suffering? And I know you've mentioned the stories that we might tell ourselves adds to the suffering of, I think so many people, Richard Rohr, I love Francis Weller, lots of connections to there's our grief, and then there's the story we have about our grief that can often lead us to regret, despair, doubt.
Yeah.
And really trip us up. What would you say to those?
Shame is one. Shame is one. Yes. I think one of the things that can trip us up is that what grief can tend to do is it is disorienting, and it makes you feel like you're on the wrong side of every door, right? Mm. When you're crying, it's I shouldn't be this sad. I should think about all the good things.
Yeah.
When you finally do laugh, I shouldn't laugh. I should be in mourning, right? Grief has this way of convincing us that if your life was a restaurant, grief has a way of convincing you that it has a standing reservation at every table, and joy is not allowed to sit down. And you find yourself living and being just one thing, and always feeling like you should be or feel something else instead of just leaning into what it is that you feel right now. And that when the tears flow, that we shouldn't be so quick to get a tissue and to wipe them away, right? And when the tears dry up and the smile, right, and the corners of our mouth start to curl upwards, we shouldn't be so quick to, drag it down and put a frown on our face, as if a frown or tears honor our loved ones more than laughter, right? Mm. I feel like people just having the freedom to feel what it is that they feel and lean into it and be very present, right? Grief constantly makes us want to like, you know, live in the past or live in the future to make some resolve of, from this point on, I'm going to honor them and I'm going to, right, build what they couldn't build. And instead of just being very present, right? That's what grief is supposed to do. It's supposed to remind us that the present is all that we have, and let's not sacrifice the joy in the present on the altar of past regret or even future promises, right?
Yeah.
Let's live in the present and be present.
I love that. You talk about the intersection of joy and grief, and I love the hopeful defiance. And I know it's, for those listening, like, it's hard to hear these words, and it, recognizing it's easier to say this on the other side of deep, deep grief. Yeah. But what would you say about that hopeful defiance? And it, I know that it's so confusing to people when they're in the middle of that grief, of this hopeful expectation that things will be different, that the impermanence of this and that things shift and change. But I'm curious what you would say to those when you're trying to explain about that intersection.
What I would say to them is that from somebody speaking 9.5 years after the loss, after lots of reflection. And so there is a way where it's like, if I was in the midst of the loss and I was playing back recordings of what I said, I would be like, how naive, you have no clue. So I say it with like full, like, if what I say sounds idealistic right now, then I am completely fine with that, right? I had a professor in school that used to say, education is a time bomb that's set to go off at a later date. Mm-hmm. And so if right now it doesn't make sense, just hold on to it, right? That I think the reality for me, what I learned is that early on, when you are on like grief's boulevard or grief's roadway, grief feels, it feels like it is a street, and it feels like hope is a parallel street. It feels like I've just got to get off of this street to be able to get on hope. But eventually, when you'll travel far enough down the pathway of grief, and you'll find yourself at an intersection, and it'll be hope. There's something that comes up, and you just find yourself at a place where it's like, oh, wait a minute. It's possible to live at the, like, grief and hope aren't parallel streets. They're streets that intersect, right?
Yeah.
And at the intersection of a street, somebody asks you, what street are you on? You say, oh, it's not an either or. I'm actually on both grief and hope. This is one of the ways that it was made powerfully clear to me. April 14, 2015, the worst day of my life, finding out that my brother died. And the crazy thing about the worst day of your life is that you secretly hope that it'll stay the worst day of your life because you never want another day to be worse than that day.
Right.
So this is April 14th, 2017. My daughter is recently born. She's been alive on this earth less than a week. She was born early, 30 weeks. So in the NICU, you know, 3.5 pounds. You know, all the machines hooked up to her. I still remember the tones of all of the beeps that reminded me that she was alive, right?
Yeah.
She had a breathing tube down her in her nose, wrapped around her back. And I remember April 14th. I remember all the unimportant things. I remember it was Good Friday. I remember holding her in such a way where I didn't want to crinkle the like breathing tube. So I was nervous. I remember the tones, right, of all the beeps that reminded me that she was alive. And before I knew it, the doctor comes, snatches her out of my hands. And before I can protest, all the beeps that reminded me that she was alive go deafeningly like silent.
Mm.
And I think all the makings of another April 14th tragedy is getting ready to take place. And he puts her back in my arm and he whispers in my ears, today's the day that she's going to breathe on her own.
No.
And what I found out was 2 years to the 2 years to the day that my brother took his last breath, my daughter takes her first breath.
Mm.
And so April 14th is a day that proves grief and hope intersect. Yeah. It proves that, that it is a grief and hope are winding roads that intersect at the most unlikely of places, but where they intersect, you capture that story and you tell that story to remind people, keep on going. Like I promise you that they do intersect. I'm not sure when or how. And in some regards, it is a, I know it's true, so I don't even care if you don't believe me, because I'm saying, oh, no, wait, you don't believe me yet.
Right.
But there is going to be something that comes on, or by God's grace, right? I pray that there will be we go to our eternal sleep, that there will be a thing that just helps you see that grief and hope intersect. And so until that takes place for us, the only thing that we can do is borrow other people's stories.
I love that. I love that. I have the podcast and we talk about grief, no matter the cultural upbringing, background, faith, practice. Grief affects us all. Given your faith practice, how has faith been impactful in your understanding? Because like you said, there's a difference between the classroom and then there's a difference between being in the country and experiencing it. You have experienced lots of other people's experiences. Yes. And then walking through, I know because personally, grief can shake. It can be very disruptive to what you believe and hold steady and true in your faith. And so how do you navigate that, or what have you learned to help others when they're in that space?
Yeah. This is what faith has done for me. And as I talk about my faith as it relates to grief, I always lead in with, I think Francis Weller is right when he says, everything in this world that we love, we will lose, period. Mm-hmm. That's the end of the sentence. And death is something that I don't know if, or nobody has solved it, right? People give us an answer about how to metabolize our grief into something beautiful. But I do think there is a lingering hopelessness or grief that comes from what was all of that just for just a lesson, right? Grief is expected. It's unavoidable. But every time it takes place, even though we know that it's going to come, there's something inside of us that just is like, wait, no, wait. You mean that this thing ends? And there's something inside of us that's like, no, this just doesn't feel right. It feels wrong. It just feels like this isn't how it's supposed to be.
Mm.
So even though it is expected, death is the most unnatural thing in the world. And I think that testifies to the fact that, oh, it is actually something that was never meant to be.
Yeah.
And I think that Christianity uniquely speaks to death, right? That as you talk about religions and faiths across the landscape, one of the things that continually draws me and draws my heart to Christianity is that it is not just a religion that's built off of worldviews or ideology. It is a faith built entirely off of an event, the most important event that deals with something that everybody in the world, regardless of their faith background, just can't fully wrap their minds and hearts around. It is death. And you have Jesus, an obscure Jewish rabbi who did amazing things here on this earth, had amassed a following with groups of folks, and they placed their hopes and dreams on him. And at the end of the day, they died, or he died, and their hopes and dreams died with him, both tangibly and ambiguously. Mm. And they buried those hopes and dreams, and those hopes and dreams went 6 feet deep, and they lived with the reality that everything in this world that you love, you will lose, period, at the end. But when Jesus got up from the grave, he took the divine pencil out of God's hand, erased the period at the end of that sentence, and replaced it with a semicolon that, all in this world that you love, you will lose. But, right, coordinating conjunction, however, there is a way to gain more than ever lost and to live life with no end. And so what you have in here is a message that deals with the things that we lose, that deals with our grief on a profound level, and gives us a renewed sense of hope that reminds me, right, because of the faith that I have, and I'm not trying to import this on anybody else, but because of the faith that I have, I live with the reality that there are times that I can feel hopeless, that I can feel like things are done, and those feelings are real.
Yeah.
However, because of my faith, I say, even though those feelings are real, those feelings are hopeless, of hopelessness are not reality. Mm. Even though I can feel it, I never actually am, because I do believe that 2,000 years ago, Jesus got up from the grave. And if he can be raised from the dead, and talk about, although his death is one of a kind, the resurrection is the first of its kind, then I trust that he can, resurrect or raise these, smaller problems. And I, in my heart of hearts, do not believe that April of 2015, when I buried Sam, will be the last time that I see him. I'll be reunited with him and loved ones and my Savior, and there will be no more goodbyes, and there will be no need for Kleenex, because those tears of sadness just won't.
I love that. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. So to end the conversation, which is a bit of a segue, or not even an easeful one. First, I want to thank you so much for being here, because I love all of this conversation. I'm honored that you are here. To end us, I wanted to see if you would answer this question.
Okay.
If you can think of an experience where the last meal you had, or the people you were with, or where you were, and it can be one of those three or all three of them combined, if you can think of that, that met all of the criteria of just blowing you out of the water, just the experience with the food, where you were, the ambiance, location, or who you were with, that was just so memorable.
The last place.
The last experience that comes to mind that could...
The last one that comes to my 40th birthday.
Which was pretty recent, right? You just had that this year.
July 23rd of this past year. I decided that for my 40th, I wanted to go somewhere out of the country with friends, with like men that have meant a whole lot to me. These relationships that have been the most vital in this last decade. And there were certain folks there that I've been best friends with 20 years, but it was 12 guys. and we are in Medellin. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. 12 of my closest
12
friends.
12 of your closest. Yeah, but you said July 23rd. You're a Leo, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm not surprised.
So we go to, there is this restaurant that we walk into the day we're getting ready to check into the Airbnb. It overlooks this incredible, like it's like the top of a mountain and you see the city there. There's like an awning. The restaurant is outside.
Wow.
They, the food is incredible. We get this like, these like steak medallions with this pureed potato, fried lobster tail on the side. The wine is great. And it's all like, it's a nice spot, but because it's there, it was like $30 or $40 for it. And we just took pictures and it was just great. And when I tell you like the group there, that was also one of the first times that I kind of mixed all of my friend groups.
Oh, that can be stressful. Mm.
It was incredible. It was the perfect right people were there. It was incredible. September of this past year was when we took the trip. And it was great.
That sounds amazing.
Oh, it was great.
And that was your first time going there?
No, second. I went there to speak 2 years ago. I enjoyed it so much. And I stumbled across a coffee shop, Pergamino. And I do not say this lightly. Pergamino in Medellin is my favorite coffee shop in the entire world.
Wow.
In 2023, I was in coffee shops on 5 different continents, right? So it's not like I'm just in a region. I've been to a lot. Pergamino, Medellin.
But you also, this is right at the end, but you opened up a coffee shop, correct?
Yes.
In Atlanta?
We started a coffee company in 2019, signed a lease for a building March of 2020, 2 weeks before the pandemic. A week before the pandemic, a movie crew sublet the inside of our spot and basically paid our rent as they stored stuff throughout the first part of the pandemic. We turned an idea for a shop into e-commerce and just the right place in the right time.
Okay. And so in Atlanta, where can people find your shop?
In the historic West End, Portrait Coffee. So if you type it, it should be there.
I'll put a link in.
5-star rating, right?
Yes. Let's
keep the 5-star rating going. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. And before, I just want people to hear what prompted you to do that, because this story is powerful.
Let me see if I can do this.
Okay. Concisely.
I got into coffee. This is 13 years ago, out of necessity, because I would travel around the country and speak. Twitter was really big back then. It was not the cesspool of indecency that it is now.
Right.
I would drop down. I would ask people, where's the best shop in Memphis, in Chicago, in Philly? And people would tell me, and I'd walk through the front door of the shop, and every coffee shop that I would go into, I would be one of the only people that looked like me. And I just felt like, this is weird. This is yet another space where it feels like every school that I've gone to, where I've been the only black kid in my class, right? So as I'm trying to find a community there that's like me, I can't really track it down. So I go home, I start to read books. I find, wait a minute. Coffee was actually discovered in Ethiopia. It's native to Africa. It grows primarily along the equator, but what's the disconnect in between this and the shop? 15 years ago, when I moved to Atlanta, I get on MARTA. It's our train system, and I ride it from south to north. Didn't really have any place to go. I was just trying to get a lay of the land, and I saw something interesting when I rode it. I would start off at airport station, the very, very south. And in the 25-minute train ride to go north, there were two things that would change: the inside of the train and the outside of the train.
Mm.
So the inside of the train, with each stop that I'd go off north, when you start off at the southmost train stop, the train is very, very black, right? It is Wakanda on the inside. And with each stop that you go up north, more black people get off the train and more white people get on. So it goes from Wakanda to Switzerland in 25 minutes. Magic trick, right?
Yeah.
But it's the outside of the train that starts to change too. With each stop that you go up north, the economic conditions, they don't only improve, they skyrocket. Yeah. So here you have this like picture of black and brown people getting off the train before they can take advantage of the economic opportunities in a city that they helped build. What I realized was that if you take the coffee supply chain and you put it right on top of that MARTA train stop, it's the exact same thing. Mm. Coffee grows along the equator. Coffee grows primarily where black and brown people grow. And with each stop that you go up north on the coffee supply chain through exporting, importing, roasting, retailing, by the time you buy the $20 bag off the shelf at your favorite hipster coffee shop,
yeah,
it contributes to a $250 billion industry of which black and brown people do not share in a proportionate amount of the wealth. And so our aim was, how do we tell a different story about coffee and try to help people remember that the founders of coffee, their faces have been forgotten, even though the pigment of the drink reflects their own, right? How do we tell a different story? And not try to edge anybody out, but just to say, there's plenty of room at the top, right?
Yeah.
So let's do our best to use coffee as a resource to maybe even help change the economic trajectory of blighted communities like ours or the one that we lived in. And often in a spot like the West End, when it gets gentrified and a coffee shop does come to town, the legacy residents that live in the community stumble into the shop. And the very first thing that they see is, whoever created the shop did not have us in mind. They imagine community transformation comes not by a community being changed, but by a community being exchanged. And we said, no, we want people that live in the West End to come into the shop and to see, oh, wait a minute, this is an amenity created for the community that does not assume the community gets better by my exit and somebody else with less pigment replacing me. This is a place that was designed with me in mind.
I love that. Yeah. Oh, I love that you have skin in that game. That's amazing. Yeah. Portrait Coffee. We'll put a link in there. John, thank you so much again for being here. This is I really am so grateful. I know that you are very, very busy and have a powerful, impactful ministry and all of the things. I cannot wait for the book in 2026 that's coming out.
Yeah.
Okay. So that two has to go to the three wing and get this done. So we have
if I get the manuscript in on time. So it's a, which if I do, it will be the first assignment I have ever turned in on time.
You've turned
in my life.
Okay, so you can do it.
Yeah. We're hopeful. Yeah.
Yes, yes. I'm gonna ask that you get some Enneagram ones around you, some threes as well. Yeah, that can help encourage you to stay on track.
I know it.
Yeah. I appreciate it. Well, thank you so much. And I hope that you have a great evening. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you next time.